The men who created and did the voices for Miss Piggy, Cookie Monster, Bert Grover, and Fozzie Bear is also a movie director. Frank Oz directed Steve Martin and Michael Caine in the new comedy Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Oz joined Jim Henson and the Muppets in 1963. He directed the Muppets on the big screen in The Muppets Take Manhattan. He directed a blood-sucking plant and a cast of humans in the movie musical comedy Little Shop of Horrors. And he was directed by George Lucas in The Empire Strikes Back, where Oz handled the puppet and the voice for Yoda, the Jedi sage. Oz's new movie, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, is about two con men who fleece wealthy women. Michael Caine is rich, elegant, and debonair. He passes himself off to women as a deposed prince who needs money to fund his country's freedom fighters. Steve Martin is the loudmouth, crass American who runs more of a nickel-and-dime scam. He hits up women for money to buy life-saving surgery for his ailing grandmother. When Steve Martin sets up shop on Michael Caine's turf, Caine devises a bet that he hopes will help him get rid of his vulgar competitor.
All right, Freddy. Suppose we try this. We find a woman, set a price, and the first man to extract the correct amount from her wins. But if you... But if you lose, you not only leave town graciously, you promise never to come back to Beaumont-sur-Mer again.
Done. Who's the woman?
Oh! Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is an updated version of Bedtime Story, which starred David Niven in the Michael Caine role and Marlon Brando in the Steve Martin role. Had you seen that before making your new movie?
Yes. Yeah, I saw it when I was about, I imagine I saw it when I was about 17 or 18. It does not loom large in my memory. I don't recall very much of it.
Did you want to see it again before making the new movie?
Yeah, I did. I requested to see it because I just thought I might be able to learn from it. And I saw it, and I did not learn a thing from it.
Well, was it disappointing? Here you were about to remake a movie, and maybe you weren't that wild about the original. Were you thinking, why am I doing this?
No, I always saw the potential in the script. I thought the script was a little gem. It was a delightful... little gem of a script, and I in seeing the original, I still felt that there was a lot of potential in the script. I just thought the execution was not the best. Here I am, you know, my egomaniacal self talking.
Well, you had originally cast Steve Martin in the David Niven role. Steve Martin in the role of the refined, elegant, upper class con man.
Right.
He ended up in the role of the loudmouth American.
Right.
Why did you initially have him in the more continental, refined role?
Well, I saw Steve in that. You know, I think Steve can do anything. And so when I first read the script, knowing a little bit of Steve, and not very much, knowing him personally from Little Shop and working with him in other times, and then socially seeing his house and just essentially knowing him to that degree, I saw that he was indeed erudite, bright, sophisticated, very smart, and very had taste. So I imagine that I was influenced by his personal life. It was Steve, after a few weeks, saying to me, you know, gee, I was thinking maybe if I did Freddy, I could have a lot more opportunity for comedy. And I said, gee, I don't know. And then eventually he won me over, and we changed it. When Michael was available.
What made you decide on Michael Caine for the other role?
Well, you know, there's not many British actors who have the stature and the talent of a Michael Caine and who fit this particular role in age, in appearance. Michael was not available in the beginning. He was doing Jack the Ripper of the series, and only towards the end of our casting did he suddenly become available because Jack the Ripper seemed to end a bit earlier than we thought. So just because he's such a talent. And he's just appropriate and just right for the role in this movie.
There's a very funny scene where Michael Caine takes on Steve Martin as his pupil and is tutoring him in the ways of the wealthy.
Oh, I'm glad you like that.
Oh, very funny. Tutoring him on how to hold a cocktail glass and how to very elegantly slip your hand into your dinner jacket while
right.
while having the appropriate amount of self-satisfied contentment on your face.
Right.
How did you shape that scene?
Well, actually, I guess I should just to point out to whoever's listening, it's really not a scene. It's a montage.
Mm-hmm.
Shortcuts put to music of Putting on the Ritz, as a matter of fact, kind of a big band version of Putting on the Ritz, which I love Miles Goodman to the music. It was in an earlier draft. It was cut out, and I put it back in because I thought teaching Freddie would be very funny if it was done. It sounds odd, but if the actors weren't trying to be funny. In other words, they're not doing shtick.
Mm-hmm.
Steve is not all of a sudden being a clown. I think the humor lies in the fact that you know that Michael Caine is conning Steve as Freddie, and the Steve as Freddie is being extraordinarily earnest and sincere in trying to learn. You know? And I think that's where the humor lies, not in any comedy shtick they're doing, because it's quite subtle, I think.
But which of you knew which gestures were the right gestures to teach, the gestures of the upper class?
Well, I just kind of put the camera there, and I said, Michael, teach them how to lean on the column. And then they did it about 20 times, and I used a few of them. And then I said, listen, they walked across from camera right to left once, I think, in order to get to their marks. And I said, hey, that's great. Go ahead and do it and teach him to walk right. And so they did it. So it was really them clowning around. Not clowning around. Here, I'm contradicting myself. I don't mean clowning around in the sense of trying to do funny stuff, but just being extemporaneous. I just put the camera on them. I said, go ahead and do some stuff. So I shot and shot and shot, and I used the gems.
Well, there's another very funny scene where Steve Martin is in jail, and the only person he knows in the town that he's imprisoned in is Michael Caine.
Right.
But he can't remember his name, and he's trying to convince the chief of police that it's on the tip of his tongue, but he's really bluffing his way through this.
Right.
And we have a clip of that scene. I want to play that.
I'll tell you about that, too.
Good.
All right, what am I going to do? How am I going to get out of here?
Well, it's very difficult. The charges are serious, one. And you are a vagrant, an unknown.
I'm not a vagrant! This is my point!
I know somebody here. I met him on a train. His name is... His name is... James... No, his name is... James Josephson.
No. James Lawrence. Lawrence! Lawrence! Lawrence... Lawrence Fells. Lawrence Fangs. Forrest Lawrenceton. His name is James Jessenton. Lawrence Fell. Lawrence Jesterton. Lawrence Jesterton.
Lawrence Jemison?
Yes! 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 We're like this!
Let me tell you about that.
Oh, great, okay.
Because in the script, what it was Steve was supposed to say that the scene goes on, and then towards the end of the scene, very, very short scene, Steve says, I know a guy here. I know someone here. I met him on a train. His name is Lawrence Jameson. Cut to Lawrence Jameson. That's what the scene was supposed to have been. And then Steve started just playing around a little bit and trying to remember his name. I said, that's great. I just kind of egged him on, supported what he was doing. I said, go ahead and try it. And so we just tried it. We did 5 takes of him, each one different, totally ad-lib, of him trying to remember the name. And I bought the 4th one. And the reason I didn't buy the 4th one right away, as opposed to buying the 4th one and not doing the 5th, I did the 5th because I was down... kneeling on the floor, cueing Anton Rogers, the other actor in the scene, when he should interrupt Steve. And I was laughing so hard, I couldn't see what Steve was doing. So therefore, I had to go to the 5th one, and then I looked at the videotape, and I realized the 4th one was the best. So again, there's a situation where it's Steve. Let me expound a little bit more, for the sake of being boring, but that's kind of a microcosm why I wanted to do this movie, because you get somebody like a Steve Martin, and a Michael Caine, and a Glenn Headley, and the other people, mainly Michael and Steve and Glenn, you want to really squeeze the juice out of their acting. And I felt a movie like this, where the lines weren't that important, really, it was the acting and performing was important. I think I felt that Steve and Michael in particular could really squeeze the juice between the lines out of the characters. And this is one example where the lines weren't important. It was the juice between the lines that was important.
You know, that scene really goes on where he's trying to remember the name.
Yeah.
And when I was seeing it in the theater, I was thinking, oh, about midway through the scene, I was thinking, oh, this is going on too long. And then a split second later, it got much funnier than it even had been.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing with timing, and I think you knew to let the timing go on with it.
Yeah, well, we did a cover on it. We did, which means we shot the other actor also. We took a picture of the other actor listening. And we could have shortened it, and we also could have lengthened it. But I felt, gee, it works. Let's just hang on, Steve. So we didn't do any cutting at all. And I think you're right. It does get funny, then it goes down a little bit, and you think it's over, and you still can't remember, and he starts getting funny again. You just take a chance and let it happen.
My guest Frank Oz directed the new film Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. A lot of our listeners who haven't yet seen the movie have perhaps seen The Coming Attractions, in which Michael Caine and Steve Martin are walking along the river looking like two very elegant chaps.
Right.
And Steve Martin reaches out and pushes an older woman into the river.
Right.
And I was surprised to find that that scene is not in the movie.
That scene is not in the movie. I'll tell you why. Because when we shot that scene, it was solely for the purpose of having what they call a teaser in the theaters, which is to give some indication to the audience what the movie will be like in December. And we would ordinarily have taken some bits of the movie that we had already shot, put them together as a teaser and shown it. But we hadn't shot enough of the movie. We had started very fast in this movie, had prepared it very quickly, so we didn't have enough material to shoot that we shot in order to edit together, and therefore we had to shoot this by itself, and as a result, by shooting by itself, it didn't fit in the movie. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it was a funny scene. I would have loved to put it in the movie, but there was just no way. There was no place for it.
The music was scored by
Miles Goodman.
By Miles Goodman, yeah. And I have to say, I think that the score is very good. There's something very continental about it. It's orchestral. It's jazz-oriented.
Yeah.
And it's almost Nina Rota-ish. And it's in its own way. I think music is very important to a movie, and choosing the right composer is very important to a film. Would you talk a little bit about how a movie is changed depending on the music behind it?
Well, Miles Goodman did music for Little Shop of Horrors also. He did music for La Bamba. He's done a lot of movies, and he's brilliant. And I knew I wanted Miles right away because there's a warmth about Miles that translates into the music, and I wanted something lush and quirky. And essentially that's what I said to Miles: make it lush, make it quirky, and make it wonderful. And he did. To answer your question, though, there's a scene in the movie where Steve is talking to Barbara Harris, and Steve starts to realize something that Barbara Harris is saying. He realizes he's been conned. Now, without the music, you see in his eyes that he's slowly realizing that he's been conned. It never really worked that well. But with the music, little tinkle of, I don't know what it was, piano or something, the music helped that moment so much that the audience realized by the second note what was going on, whereas before the music, it took a little longer to realize. So the music really supports emotional moments more than anything else.
To my knowledge, this is your first film that doesn't have puppets or a puppet-like plant in
it.
What's your relationship to puppetry and the Muppets now?
Well, I'll always be with the Muppets. I just will work about 10% of the year and not 100%. I'll be going on. I'm looking for a drama to do next. But I just went up to Toronto and shot a day there for the new Jim Henson Hour coming on television next year. And I'll do Sesame Street for like 2 days a year. Because I love the characters and I love the people, but essentially I'll try and squeeze some of that stuff in between movies now.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your work with puppets, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is film director and puppeteer Frank Oz. He directed the new film Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which stars Steve Martin and Michael Caine. This is Fresh Air. In addition to directing Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, my guest Frank Oz was also an original member of Jim Henson's Muppet team. He created the characters of Miss Piggy, Bert Grover, Fozzie Bear, and the Cookie Monster. He also directed the films The Dark Crystal, The Muppets Take Manhattan, and the remake of The Little Shop of Horrors. You did puppets as a kid, and I wonder what kind of puppet shows you did.
Oh, I did variety shows, marionette variety shows, three-minute little acts strung together for about 20 minutes for supermarket openings and birthday parties and parking lots and fairs and church gatherings and anything like that. I made about $30 for a half an hour show.
How did you end up staying with puppets as an adult? I think most adults would think of puppets as something a kid will outgrow when they get older.
Just a very weird, sick person, I think, is pretty much the answer. Well, actually, I wanted to be a journalist. I did puppets really as a means of, I think, expressing myself because they were ready at hand, because it pleased my parents. I was able to make some money as a youngster. I say between 11 and 17. Of course, when I'm 17, you never consider yourself a youngster. And then I decided, I never wanted to be a puppeteer. Never had a desire to be a puppeteer professionally. I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to write a column in a paper. And then when I was about 19, I came to New York. Jim had asked me to work for him part-time, and I hadn't
Jim Henson
really
of the Muppets.
Right, I haven't stopped since.
Uh-huh. What do you think is different about the Muppets than puppets which preceded it?
Yeah, well, I think it's the tight shot of cameras. I think the tight shot of television created a particular style that Jim did. And that is that when you're working with normal puppets, and again, I'm not crazy about puppets. I care much more about character, and that's why I love Muppets, because they do characters. But I think that the tight shot, the close-up in a TV situation, forces a puppet not to be just a wooden doll. It forced Jim, I think, in his creativity, to have a mouth that opens and speaks in sync and have a cloth instead of wood, and the cloth is malleable, and you can be much more subtle with your hand. I think that close-up really made the difference to Jim, and it both forced him and allowed him to break some bonds of puppetry. He did that. I had nothing to do with that. I wasn't even there.
The puppets were also outside of the proscenium. There's no little puppet theater.
That's it, yeah, because a proscenium situation, first of all, it's a wide shot. The puppets kind of wiggle. It bores the hell out of me. Puppets are wiggling around, but they just kind of wiggle around and move, and your eye shifts to them. In a proscenium situation, they have to make large motions because it's a proscenium, because there's a lot of space to play with. In a close-up, that close-up is the new proscenium, was the new proscenium, still is. And you don't have to wiggle the doll. You have to be more subtle. You have to be more succinct. You have to be more specific in your movements. And I think that close-up compared to the proscenium really made the difference. It was the germ of what happened with the Muppets and Jim.
I think the superstar of all the puppets, of all the Muppets that you created, was Miss Piggy. And if you could tell us what inspired her.
I'll be damned if I know. I don't know. I think, actually, it's always in conjunction with the writers and Jim, the director. She was a pig, as there must have been half a dozen pigs in the first year of the Muppet Show, which kind of loosely used in the show. And at one point, it was Richard Hunt, who's another performer, and myself. We kind of used her at different times. And one show, I did her, and she came out of the chorus and attacked the frog romantically. And from that moment on, people started to laugh at her, and I started to have ideas with her and the writers. And then I took over. I said to Richie, it seems like I'm getting somewhere with her. And he said, fine. But I don't know what happened. All I know is that whatever neuroses I have has been filtered through her in some entertaining way, or used to have maybe. And so she is now what I like about her, she's a very layered character. There's a lot of neuroses built inside her. And I've always felt that what's humorous about her is that she hides her pain.
Well, I want to play a short clip of your voice as Miss Piggy from the movie that you directed, The Muppets Take Manhattan. And in this scene, Miss Piggy is working at the perfume counter of a department store.
Oh, yeah.
And working with her is Joan Rivers, and they're selling a perfume called Quelle Différence.
I'll tell you about that, too.
Let's hear the scene first.
Get your Quelle Différence! It's French! It's feminine! It'll help you grab one of those rotten, stinking men! Quelle Différence!
Peter, please! You know, you look fine this morning. Something happened at lunch.
My frog turned on me.
Yeah, I had some bad tuna myself.
I'm gonna fight for him, though. I mean, do you think I'm pretty?
course you are. You're more than pretty.
Gorgeous.
Don't push it, Pig.
You were saying there was a story behind that?
I was directing that movie also, and we rented Bergdorf Goodman's on a Sunday, in the morning and a Sunday all day, and Joan had to leave. She had an engagement that evening, some performance she had to do. So we only had her for one day, and not a complete day either. So I had two cameras going, and the scene really, although you didn't play at all, it ends with them hysterically giggling and losing control, just laughing like two friends laugh. It just wasn't working. I mean, it's very hard to, if you try, it's very hard to have a spontaneous laughter. It wasn't working. And because I didn't know Joan that well, I guess she didn't know me. So I said to one of the production assistants who were close to the Plaza Hotel, I said, get about four Bloody Marys. So they came back after looking, and I had a couple Bloody Marys, and Joan had a couple Bloody Marys. And we shot the scene kind of like that. And actually, then Joan left. I had to do some pickup work. And I was feeling real good, and I didn't care where the hell the cameras were.
Well, it must be hard to do the voice of a character and direct at the same time.
Yeah, well, Jim and I have been...
Well, were you manipulating the puppet, too?
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Jim and I have been doing that. I think in Muppets Take Manhattan, I wrote it, too, and so I was egomaniacal enough to think I could do all that stuff, doing the characters Fozzie and Piggy and Animal, all that stuff. But Jim does that, too. I learned so much from Jim. He when he directed the other Muppet movies, he did his characters, Kermit and Swedish Chef and Rolf, etc. But I don't know how to answer that. It's harder, yeah.
I'm trying to listen to your voice and hear how it's become the characters of Miss Piggy and Bert and Grover and
Don't
Fozzie
even
Bear.
Try. I'm amazed that I do Miss Piggy, first of all. The others I can understand a bit more. Piggy is beyond me. I have no idea how I do that. I mean, it's just, fortunately, I don't have to think about it. Neither do I have to think about the other characters. They're just there. They just happen. They're there after all these years.
When you're manipulating the character of Miss Piggy,
mm-hmm.
where are
Which
you?
Which I don't How do you, much anymore,
you,
actually.
You have other people do that?
No, nobody does my characters. Nobody does Jim's characters. Nobody does the other performers' characters. I just don't use her that much anymore. I try and save her for special occasions.
I can't believe she's allowing you to retire her.
I'm not retiring her.
She's so aggressive.
No, I'm not retiring at all. I'm just saving. I'm saving her for special situations, special TV shows, special moments, because she's a very special character, and also because I don't have time. I have a family, and I'm working on movies and all that stuff.
Now, you did the role of Yoda for, was it The Empire Strikes Back? I forget which in
Both
the series it was.
Empire Strikes Back and Revenge of the Jedi.
Did you do the voice and manipulate the puppet?
Yep. Not at the same time. I looped the voice afterwards, months later, which means I put the voice in after we shot it, months later in the recording studio.
Magicians are very secretive about how they do their magic acts. Are puppeteers that way, too? Are the secrets of how Yoda works ever revealed to laymen?
Yeah. Yeah, find a layman, I'll tell him. Yeah, I mean, it's...
Not that I'd understand it anyways, probably, but I mean, are you guys secretive about that kind of stuff?
No,
mm-hmm.
Not me. I think when The Empire Strikes Back came out and Yoda was brand new, we were trying to be secretive then, because George and me and everybody, we didn't want to talk about how it's done, because then people will... talk about how it's done. What you want is to talk about the character.
Is it ever frustrating when you're working with real actors after you've worked with puppets for so long? You know, with a puppet, if you don't like the movement, you change it. You move your arm. You move the rod or whatever. You're working with an actor. They're a real person, and you can't just, you know, do the equivalent of pulling their strings.
You mean as a director or a performer?
As a director.
Well, it's bizarre. It's a question that's asked often in some form. And when I direct... which is a misnomer in the first place, but because you don't direct people, you work with them. But when I work with the performers, the puppeteers, I don't work with the puppets. I don't, I don't talk to the puppets. I talk to the professional, hardworking people who, worked for 20 years. And essentially the difference between them and the normal actors, and they are actors, is that they will use puppets as a tool, and the actors will use their own bodies as a tool. Essentially, there's not much difference.
Mm-hmm.
And so... I consider myself talking to actors either way.
When you were young...
I mean, I have to have an awareness of what the puppets do and what humans
right,
do.
Right, right. And I appreciate what you're saying. When you were young, and a lot of people expected you to outgrow puppets, you kept with them. Are you expected now to, in a way, outgrow puppets for dramatic films or comedic films with actors instead of puppets? Are you back into that stage of like, oh, well, you can get out of it now. You can leave the puppets behind now.
I don't know what's expected of me. I'm not sure. I think some people expect me to do only family-oriented movies. Some people expect me to stay with puppets. Some people expect me now to leave puppets and only do comedy. But mostly, I think people don't give a damn. I mean, I'm not that well known, and that people should waste a few seconds of their lives thinking about what Frank Oz is going to do. I'll just go ahead and do it. Hopefully, is best for my growth and what feels right, you know.
Your last name, Oz, is a shortened version of
it's
your
a
family
sham.
Name.
It's a sham. It's a lie. I use Oz, my real and legal name, and I'm proud of it, and I'll never change it, is Osnowitz. I just use Oz because at one time I was doing a TV show, and the person who was asking me to take a bow could not pronounce Osnowitz, and it was a weekly show, and I got bored, and so with a suggestion of a friend, made it Oz. And so I use Oz, but it's not real.
But you knew what you were doing when you chose that as your name, huh?
Only not knew it. I've always been in school. My brother and I have been called Oz or Ozzy, so it's nothing really new. It's just an extension of that. I don't particularly like the connotation of the Wizard of Oz and people.
Why not?
Well, because there's a wonderment about it. There's a fainess about it, and it's boring to me. Essentially, there's no planned association. It just because that's what people called me when I was a kid anyway.
Okay, well, listen, thanks so much.
I mean, I love The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, yeah, Okay. Just in case we were wondering about it.
Yeah, it's just the use of it in my life, that's all. Anyway, thank you very much.
Frank Oz's new film, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, stars Steve Martin and Michael Caine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.